Good morning and welcome to Midday on Minnesota Public Radio. I'm Gary Eichten. Glad you could join us. State Today is releasing a list of elementary schools that have come up short on test scores and need to improve. The report is the outgrowth of a federal effort to identify which schools are failing to provide an adequate education to low-income students despite receiving extra federal money to help educate those students. In Minnesota, 56 schools have failed to improve sufficiently on the Minnesota Comprehensive Assessments, a series of tests given to third and fifth graders. Those are the schools on the list being released today. However, we should note that some of those same schools being identified as having problems have also been praised as being some of the best schools in the state. Well, joining us today to try to explain that seeming paradox, as well as look ahead to some of the big education issues likely to come up when the legislature convenes in 2 weeks, and of course take your questions as well. Joining us today is Minnesota's Education Commissioner, Christine Jacks, the head of the state's Children, Families, and Learning Department. Education is our subject this hour, and if you have a question for Commissioner Jacks, give us a call here. Our Twin City area number is 651-227-6000, 651-227-6000. Outside the Twin Cities, you can reach us toll-free, and that number is 1-800-242-2828, 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828. Commissioner, thanks for coming in today.
It's always a pleasure.
Now, parents whose students attend some of these schools that are on the official list today, should they panic? Are their children being shortchanged?
I don't think they should panic, but I think that they should be concerned. And I think it's also important to note, you were talking about the inconsistency that we are saying some of these schools need improvement while others are saying they don't. I think it's important to realize that just like no person is totally bad or totally good, no school is totally bad or totally good. What we found is that with these tests, with the MCA tests, we have schools that are struggling, and we want to make sure that we give them the support they need to improve. And parents should be concerned if their kids are in one of these schools, but that concern should manifest itself into them perhaps volunteering more, making sure their own student is doing well, their own child, helping with the homework. This is a way to rally people to go in and help these schools.
Will the schools be getting actually extra federal money now to try to get them up the snuff?
They will be getting a little bit extra money, and they will be getting more technical support from us. We will go into the schools and work with them to look at other indicators of success. The first test here to figure out whether a school needs improvement is the MCA, the third and fifth grade MCAs in reading and math. But once we find out a school is struggling, we're going to go in and look at other things, parental involvement, governance structure, leadership, curriculum assessment, and we're going to give them some guidance and help them use their own expertise and what they know about their kids to go forward and improve. And that's what this is about. This is about improvement. This is not about pointing fingers at schools or alarming people. It's letting parents know where there's concern and how we can all help.
Longer term, though, if the schools get the extra help, they get the extra money, and there's still not much improvement, what happens?
Well, hopefully we'll have more information at that point. If we're looking at other things other than the tests, if we're in there looking at everything else that's happening in the school, we believe that we'll be able to identify what else needs to be worked on. If after 3 years, 5 years, a school is still struggling, then I think we'd have to give some serious consideration to reconstitution. Is there just something about that mix that needs to be changed? But there are a lot of steps ahead of time, a lot of assessment and a lot of support we can give to get the schools to improve.
I'm wondering, given all the variables, student, the actual student body makeup, money, on and on and on, is there any realistic way to compare schools to say this is a good school, this one isn't?
Well, I think that it's difficult to compare schools. There are ways, and we're actually going to develop some software and have information up on our website to guide parents in making those kinds of comparisons. So if they want to see what their kid's school is doing and want to do a comparison, they will be comparing to a school with similar demographics, similar student population. But what we're talking about with these schools is a raw number. These are schools whose average score on the MCAs is below 1420. And we think that that is cause for concern and cause for some intervention, some resource help, some technical assistance help. And that's what we're going to do. And we do know that a lot of these schools are in Minneapolis and St. Paul, and we know that they have students who have higher poverty rates, more students who don't speak English as a first language. that's a reason. That's not an excuse. That helps us understand why this happens in particular pockets in particular neighborhoods. But that's not a reason to sit back and say, well, oh, well, this is why these kids are not reading. They need to read, and they need to be able to do the math. So the important thing is to find out which schools these are and get in there, roll up our sleeves, and make a difference for these kids.
Overall, is the K-12 education system better today than it was a year ago? You know, we get to the end of these years, and it's always nice to kind of look back, see what's happened, what hasn't happened. Do you think much progress has been made in the last year?
I think we're always making progress. We have teachers who are continuously going through their own professional development, so they're always improving. We're getting better at as a system with what we're doing, such as implementing the graduation standards. We're doing a better job identifying what schools need help through our MCA tests. I think we've done a great job of finding out what students were at risk of not passing the basic skills test and eventually getting most of our students, the vast majority of our students, to pass the basic skills test. So I think as a system, we're improving, and I think the individuals are improving. But that brings up a good point. You know, when we're talking about these particular schools that have been deemed needing improvement, I think that we should also acknowledge that all schools can continue to improve. All people can continue to improve. So saying that someone needs to improve or a school needs to improve is not a negative. You know, that's part of human nature and becoming the best.
Mm-hmm. If you could jump ahead in time, and this were this time next year, is there any one thing that you'd like to be able to look back and say, well, here's what we were able to accomplish this past year that was really important?
I think that identifying these schools and getting in there and really making a difference. These Title I schools are made up of children, primarily children of color, children who are in poverty, children who don't speak English as their first language. These are people who are entitled to participate in the American dream, who believe in the American dream, and yet we've haven't met their needs as well as we can. I would really like to look back and say all Minnesotans really are getting their fair chance, are really getting the opportunity they need. I think that we could all be happy with that.
State Education Commissioner Christine Jacks is our guest this hour, and she's joined us today to talk about the full range of education issues. Thought it particularly timely, what with the release today of this report on some of the schools that have failed to make adequate progress in terms of test scores. And also, given the fact that the legislature starts meeting again in 2 weeks, and lots of big issues again before the legislature. If you'd like to join our conversation, give us a call, 651-227-6000, 651-227-6000. If you're calling from outside the Twin Cities, you can reach us toll-free, and that number is 1-800-242-2828, 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828. First caller's from Minneapolis. Nestor, your question, please.
Hi, I just want to say I think that it's great that you're looking at more than standardized tests, because standardized tests cannot give the full picture of what the students are. I've got friends who are both teachers in Minneapolis and St. Paul, both at lower-end schools in testing because of impoverished students, as well as students who are really transitory. Might be there only for a month or 2 months in a classroom and then move on to another school because of rent hopping. And also are learning in their second or sometimes even third language. And so I think it is important to look at more than the standardized tests, because I've been to my friend who teaches at North End in St. Paul, and he does some great stuff bringing the parents in for to learn. They give their kids he does a thing called Bear University where he has the kids learn about research on bears and then brings in their parents or other adults to learn from the kids on how to research.
Mm-hmm.
And it gives a chance for these kids, many who are Southeast Asian refugees or Horn of Africa refugees, to show what they know, but on the standardized test they can't perform at the level of somebody who's been raised in the English language or okay. In a good middle class home. And so I just
All right. Thanks.
Want to stress that.
Thanks, Nestor.
I think that's very important. I think that what I really heard him saying I agree with, and that is that we have to look at multiple ways of assessing students. But we have to get students who are not at the basic level or at a level we think they should be up to par, especially refugees, people who are coming into our country to participate. We need to make sure they can participate as self-sufficient citizens. And yet we do need to celebrate what they already know, give them an opportunity to show what they know. One of the best lessons I learned is, for years we've said ESL, English as a Second Language. And I was in a Minneapolis school and used that acronym, and someone pointed out to me, it was a student, that was offensive, because for a lot of these students, as your listener pointed out, it's not their second language. For a lot of students, it's their third language or fourth language. So they may be struggling with English, and we may need to give them a lot of help, but we should applaud what they can do, and in some cases, it's speaking more languages than the rest of us.
Is this discussion too often in your mind kind of cast as an either-or proposition? Either you have to focus on the basic skills tests, or you have to kind of focus on this broader, all these other measurements and so on and so forth, to the exclusion of the other?
Well, that's interesting. I find that happen in education in general. I think we have such a complex society that any time people can simplify an argument to better understand it, they do so. And what happens is we wind up polarizing ourselves. And people will say, are you for the grad standards or are you against the grad standards? Are you for standardized tests or are you against it? Do you think the improvement model that we have is good or is it bad? When generally the correct answer is probably somewhere in between, or it's a combination of answers, or it's depending on what you look for. Your last caller talked about us not using just testing. Well, it is our first cut. We first look at the test to determine whether a school needs help, and then we look at the other issues involved. I think that what's also going to happen are people are going to start characterizing some of these schools as bad schools, and I think it's very important that we don't do that. These are schools with students who are struggling, students we need to help, but these are not bad schools.
Jim, your question, please.
Yes. First, I would just like to ask the commissioner a personal question. In what field did you take your PhD?
Educational Policy and Administration.
Oh, thank you. And secondly, what is the average cost per pupil year in Minnesota? The average expenditure per pupil year.
Oh, you know what? I don't have that in front of me right now.
Would you guess it's where? Somewhere in the area of $7,000?
I was going to say $7,000 with everything included.
Okay, and of that, roughly half is state and half is local?
Well, it depends on the district, if you're talking about whether you're including the property tax in that or not. The state does pay half of what comes off of the property tax, but if you look at what the state is either equalizing or what the state is covering, including the property tax, the state is probably covering about 80%.
Okay. Next question.
Okay, this is your last one, Jim.
Okay. vouchers, it would seem to me that's a win-win situation for the state. Say you had a $1,000 voucher. The school that is unsatisfactory to a parent, and they're willing to spend, say, what is the BREC charge a year for tuition, maybe $7,000 or $8,000 a year. If they're willing to pop for $6,000 for tuition to BREC, and they can pick up an extra $1,000 from a state voucher, that might be the thing that would let them pull a kid out of that school. The school still has, say, $6,000 left from that exiting pupil. Wouldn't that be a win-win situation, that the school has more resources and one less pupil, and the parent gets to put the kid in the school that suits them?
Well, there are a lot of good things that could be said about vouchers and the free marketplace, but some of the concerns would be that the students who would not be able to participate in the example that you just mentioned would be some of the very students we're talking about this morning, students who are struggling, students from poverty. And what you could end up with is what we call a creaming effect, where it's the more wealthier students, the students who have parents who are who have more resources, who maybe have more opportunity and time to become more familiar with the schools, leaving the public schools and leaving behind our students who are poor, students from other countries, students who are struggling. That's one concern. And the other concern, of course, is the separation of church and state and the concern that many Minnesotans have that they don't want their tax dollars used to support the religious schools and students who've chosen to go to religious schools.
Would you expect under a Bush administration now that we will in fact move though toward a kind of voucher system, at least for the students who are in schools that are deemed to be failing?
I think that it's going to be very difficult to predict what President-elect Bush will do. Had he actually won the popular vote, had he come in with a strong mandate, I would say definitely that, you know, that's his philosophy, that we should have vouchers. But I think we're going to see him be very cautious and really look at issues because he has to bring the country together. So if he sees something as very divisive, I don't know that he'll go down that path. There might be some hybrids that could be looked at. Maybe he'll bring forward something that is a voucher system, but religious schools are not eligible. Maybe there would be a sliding fee scale, so some of our poor students would have the same opportunity. I think there are some things that the president-elect could look at.
I know you were concerned and interested in getting full funding for special education in the state of Minnesota, which would amount to about $250 million in federal money. Is that likely to occur under a Bush administration? Vice President Gore had indicated that that might very well be one of his top education priorities if he were elected, but of course he wasn't.
Right. It would have been far more likely under his administration, but President-elect Bush has talked about the importance of getting more funding for special education. And while he didn't come right out and promise the full funding that the government did promise all of the states, he got awfully close. So I think that we can be hopeful. What I would say to all of your listeners is that this is something that I think people underestimate their own individual power. If every single teacher in the country contacted Congress, this could get through. And certainly, if everybody who's even listening right now called Congress and said, we want the money you promised us. Federal government, you have an unfunded mandate. You promised us the money. It's costing us $250 million. If the citizenry became activated, I think we'd get it. And with $250 million, a lot of our other concerns would be taken care of.
Leanna, your question, please.
Hi, good morning, Gary, Commissioner Jack.
Good morning.
I'm a Minneapolis resident, and I attended the Minneapolis public schools for a period of time, and later was sent to a private school in St. Paul, and I did quite well. I have a question for Commissioner Jack. You said earlier that a lot of the failing schools had a lot of poor students, students from other countries who were not proficient in English, and a lot of students of color. And I wanted to clarify something with you. Are you suggesting that there are special challenges for students of color regardless of their income, or are you saying that they're all poor students and a lot of them happen to be from minority groups, but the real issue is poverty, maybe the education level of the parents? That wasn't clear to me.
Well, the real issue is, well, there is the issue of poverty. There's also an issue of racialized poverty, and then there's an issue of concentrated poverty. And you see all of those things coming together in urban cores across the country. So I would not want to say that black students need to be sitting next to white students in order to learn, or that there is some reason that they have more difficulty learning. But I do want to add that there is a fair amount of research that says that our black students, especially ones who are not coming over from other countries, have different learning styles that our system has not always addressed. Students tend to be more, a little bit more verbal. They tend to be a little bit more physical. And often these are things that cause teachers to see as disciplinary problems, and we do see that our black students, regardless of their poverty level, are over-labeled and put into emotionally behaviorally disturbed courses, and so they are often pulled out of mainstream classes. So while I would not say that the overriding issue is a race issue, I don't think that we can say there is not a race issue.
Mm-hmm. Duke, you're up next. Your question?
Yes, Commissioner, isn't one of the problems with performance in schools in general, and maybe urban schools in particular, the fact that our standards aren't very good? I have in my hands here, I have a report that your group, the CFL, commissioned from Achieve, that looked specifically at the profiles of learning. And they make several points here, and I think this is a devastating report against the profiles. It says that the standards lack clarity and specificity. Important topics are missing or underemphasized. There's inadequate rigor and growth across grade levels, and it's particularly in English, math, science, and history, the core subjects, the profile comes under attack in this report. And don't you think that if we step back and took another look at what we've done with our curriculum here in this state, that we might be able to do a little bit better and have better results?
Yeah, well, that's why we wanted to have the Achieve report done. When I took this position, there were concerns about our standards, and I said it's time to have an outside organization look at them to see where we can make improvement. And certainly the Achieve report does show us some areas where we can improve. Now, I don't agree with you that it's a sweeping indictment of the standards, because they actually come right out and tell us right in that report that you've got in your hand to stay the course. And they also talk about the importance that we're doing the performance assessment and the applied learning. So I think that we have to take very seriously what this report says and look at whether we do need more clarity and specificity and whether we do need to beef up the content. Now, the flip side to that is, as you, especially Duke knows, since he has the report in front of him, what they're asking for is more state intervention and more state control, more state alignment of these standards. I think that's an important discussion that we have to have in Minnesota. This is a state where generally we leave that up to the locals, where we say, here is the standard, here's the bar, you decide the content, you decide how specific we need to be. But we may need to look at a change in that. What I think the listeners should know, though, that the next step is that this Achieve report is being analyzed by a group of Minnesota experts, teachers of the year, PTA, superintendent, school board association, principals, etc. And they're going to come back with a recommendation as to what really makes sense in this report, what we should listen to, what doesn't make sense for us, and what really would work in Minnesota. These are not only Minnesota educational experts, these are people who've worked with the profile. It's an important report, but we have some more information coming forward.
Are you expecting another effort will be made during the legislative session to abolish the profile of learning?
Well, I think that there are some people who are making sweeping generalizations about it being bad. It kind of going back to what we talked about earlier, the polarization of people. I think that that's really dangerous. Anytime we try to simplify something as complex as our standards or anything in education, I think it's also not healthy for a dialogue in the state if we want to continue to be a leader and continue to move forward. So I'm hoping that won't happen. What I'm hoping will happen is that we will take a very enlightened and grown-up approach to this and look at what the report says, what our experts say, and figure out what needs to be fixed and fix it, and not throw the baby out with the bathwater.
So that would be a yes. You figure another effort will be made to eliminate the profile of learning?
Well, there are people who have who ran campaigns saying they were going to do that, people who get money from national organizations in order to do that. So, yes, there are people out there who are going to try to do that. But I think that we have more information about where it's working. I think we've given a lot more flexibility to our teachers, and we have many more teachers who are supportive. So I think it'll be a different kind of dialogue.
I was going to ask, last year there were some several changes made to the way the program operates. In general, are you satisfied that those changes have addressed most of the concerns that people had expressed?
Well, that's very interesting. I am satisfied that locals have the control they need, that teachers now have the autonomy and the control they need to do what they know is the best for their classroom. But what's interesting is this Achieve report really does want more state control. And one of the things that this group was concerned about, this Achieve group, is that there is so much flexibility. They don't like the idea that some districts were able to choose fewer standards than other districts. So that might be even part of the conversation. There are going to be people who will look at this report and say, do districts have too much flexibility?
Education Commissioner Christine Jacks is our guest this hour. She's come by today to take your questions on education issues, a particularly interesting time, I think, given the fact that the Minnesota Legislature will convene for its new session in just 2 weeks, and education is always one of the top items on the legislative agenda. If you have a question for Education Commissioner Jacks, give us a call here, 651-227-6000, 651-227-6000, outside the Twin Cities, 1-800-242-2828. We'll get to more of your calls here in just a couple of minutes. But first of all, we have something of our own basic skills test to pass here. This is a test of the emergency alert system. That was a test of the emergency alert system, and presumably we passed. Minnesota Public Radio is looking for the next generation of members and hope you'll become one. Just click and join online at minnesotapublicradio.org. News headlines now. Here's Greta Cunningham. Greta?
Thanks, Gary. Good morning. President-elect Bush has named Paul O'Neill, a businessman and veteran of another Republican administration, to be his Secretary of the Treasury. Bush said signs of an economic slowdown made it incredibly important to have a man of vast experience and a steady hand in the job. Three other cabinet positions are expected to be filled today. There's word that New Jersey Governor Christine Whitman has agreed to head the Environmental Protection Agency. Bush is also planning to nominate Don Evans as Commerce Secretary, Mel Martinez as Housing Secretary, and Ann Veneman as the first woman to head the Department of Agriculture. Bush has a month left before he takes office. President Clinton today is signing new privacy protections that sharply limit doctors, hospitals, and insurance companies from sharing confidential medical information about their patients. Until now, there's been no federal law protecting medical privacy. Chile's Supreme Court has thrown out the indictment that charged former dictator Augusto Pinochet with homicide and kidnapping. The justices say the case wasn't properly handled. The decision leaves open the possibility for new charges against the 85-year-old. The retired general has been charged with organizing what's known as the Caravan of Death in 1973. That was a military operation that executed 73 political prisoners. In regional news, National Weather Service forecasters say an Alberta Clipper is moving through Minnesota today and is bringing blowing snow and reduced visibility. Forecasters say winds are expected to reach as high as 35 miles per hour. Parts of northern North Dakota have received up to 4 inches of snow this morning. At least 7 school districts in northwestern Minnesota have canceled classes today. There is a winter storm warning and advisory for the north today and tonight, a winter weather advisory for far west central Minnesota this afternoon and tonight, and a winter weather advisory for the southwest tonight. Snow is likely statewide. It will turn windy this afternoon with blowing and drifting snow developing this afternoon. Highs from 5 above in the north to the teens in the south. Right now, Rochester reports some light snow, a temperature of 6 above. St. Cloud reports a temperature of 8 above. It's overcast in Duluth and 9 above. And in the Twin Cities, cloudy skies, a temperature of 9 above. Gary, that's a look at the latest news.
Thanks, Greta. It's 27 minutes before noon, midday coming to you on Minnesota Public Radio. And our guest this hour is State Education Commissioner Christine Jacks. Full bank of calls, callers with questions for Commissioner Jacks. But before we get back to the callers, I have a question for you, Commissioner. The governor has made a real point about shifting the way the state pays for education, and the idea being that the state would pick up 100% of the basic cost of education, and then if the local school districts wanted to add on to that, they could. That would have a significant impact, presumably, on the property tax system. Would it make any difference to the education system?
Not really. It wasn't really intended to. It is tax reform. That's really what the governor is all about this session, tax reform and tax relief. What it does for the educational system is that it ends what he refers to as the shell game. What happens right now is the state says to districts, you must go levy your people, tax them on their property for this money. Then give it to us, and then we're going to give it back to you in the form we think we should give it back to you in. And he thinks that shuffling back and forth doesn't make sense, and that it's also difficult for the taxpayer to figure out who's responsible. He wants taxpayers to be able to look at their property tax and know that it's something that their elected officials locally actually brought forward. So it's about responsibility and accountability. Some of the concerns that people bring up, one is that they're afraid this won't be more money. Well, it isn't designed to be more money, so it will not be new money. The other concern is that they think it will be more state intervention. That's not the case. It's already our money. The state's already bringing it forward. If we wanted more accountability, we could already do that. But the constitutional obligation for an education is the state's responsibility. We are doing the most funding, so it's just ending the shell game.
Would, under a system like that, would all the schools then at least have enough money to so that the teachers wouldn't have to buy supplies and the rest, and that this extra amount that would be raised through the could be raised through the property tax truly would be for extras?
We believe so. We believe that what would happen is that since there would be more capacity in the property tax area, that the referendum locally would pass more easily, and they would have the money that they need for extras. And one of the things we are looking at is that whether there needs to be more considered part of the basic. But right now, we think that just shifting and fixing the tax system is the best way to improve.
Stephanie, your question, please.
Yes, Commissioner Jacks, with the anticipated teacher shortage, I was just wondering, what is your opinion, since some people say teachers are underpaid and others say they are overpaid, what would you say is the average starting salary for teachers in the Twin City area?
I see numbers all of the time, and I wasn't prepared for that specific question. I think that the average teacher salary for their 9-month contract in the Twin City area is about 40.
Mm-hmm. That's certainly the statewide average for teachers, a little over $40,000. That figure just came out.
Yeah,
the starting salary would be less than that, presumably.
Well, the starting salary, I think, that is really the issue. When I talk to people, when I talk to teachers, the real concern is, and when I look at the whole system, the real concern is the number of people who leave the field in the first 3 to 5 years and the number of people who don't even want to go into the field. And there are two things they talk about. One, they talk about that the starting salary is too low. The other thing they talk about is it's not a career path. And one of the things that we really have to look at is how we're going to appeal to the next generation. And this next generation is predicted to have, 5-7 different careers, not just different jobs. So when they look at a field where you can be a teacher for 5 years and then a teacher and then a teacher and then a teacher and 30 years later you're still a teacher, we're going to lose a lot of our best and brightest kids into other fields. The other thing we have to look at is how to get people mid-career. If we have a scientist at 3M who's 35 years old and who says, I've been doing this, but I want to make a difference. I want to work directly with kids. I want to help society. Well, we can't expect that person to come in at $26,000 a year and can't ask them to go back to school to get this pedagogical training and then to student teach for free. We have to find some other ways to get that person in and get the knowledge in hand and get them in with students if they're going to be good with students.
I know there's been a lot of discussion about changing the way teachers are paid, moving away from the current system, which is based on education, achievement, and seniority. Is that likely to happen?
Well, I can't give too many details because the governor has not released what his budget is going to be and where he wants to put money. But I can say that we have brought forward a performance pool to the governor, and he does seem interested in it. So I think there's a possibility that we will have something out there. And what the proposal is that any district that wants to participate, it's voluntary, they would get an additional $150 per student to construct locally an alternative compensation plan. They could reward student or reward teachers. They could reward groups of teachers in a school. They could give more money for maybe nationally board certified teachers. They could reconstruct steps and lanes to make it easier for them to get the math and science special education teachers they need. They could do a variety of different things to retain and recruit teachers.
And then another aspect of the teacher pay issue, some school districts complain that they basically are not in a position to bargain with their teachers. They can't certainly afford to take a strike and shut the schools down, and so they tend to grant pay raises that are often in excess of what they can afford. That leads then to the talk about a statewide collective bargaining arrangement. Are we likely to move in that direction?
I don't know if we'll move in that direction, but I think that there'll be a lot of discussion about it. I've talked to plenty of teachers who think that that's probably necessary, as well as superintendents. I think that it could solve some problems, but we're investigating what the unintended consequences would be. Would there be some other difficulties? And I don't know if it would be statewide. It might have to be regional, because we do have regional economic centers in our state. There are some differences in the cost of living and the standard of living. So we'd have to look at all of those things. What's important is that we find ways to get people into the field and get people to stay in the field. This is our workforce for tomorrow, the students who are in the K-12 system, and we need to make sure that we have the best we can have teaching them.
Tom, your question, please.
Good morning, Gary. Good morning, Commissioner Jacks.
Good morning.
I have a brief question. 1997, Governor Arnie Carlson at the time started a pilot project that was funded for 3 years called Computers for Schools, and I have children that attend a school that benefited from this program. It was kind of left high and dry, and under the new administration, it was not funded. It's been picked up as a private nonprofit, but it's currently lacking sufficient funding. This program places high-technology computers in schools for free, and I'm wondering if there would be any circumstances that the commissioner would see future funding of that program to extend it, because obviously the need is just going to get bigger.
What you're talking about is a pilot project that got used computers into schools after they were refurbished by our prisoners. And it was set in motion to be a 3-year pilot project to be picked up by the private sector. And the Blandon Foundation, I believe that's who picked it up, has been covering it since the funds ran out, as they were designed to do. And last I heard is that it was still successful and they were not running out of funds, that the private sector was stepping up to the plate here. It's a good program. When I talk to school districts, they find that it's real helpful for basic research, basic keyboarding and typing. These are old computers. The technology changes so quickly. I mean, something can be, an old computer after just a year. And they say that, sometimes that they don't have the capacity that they want, but they really like having them there. So I think it's an important program, but I think this is something that was designed to shift to the private sector, and I think that's where it belongs.
Linda, your question, please.
Oh, hi, Commissioner. I have a question about special education. I live in the Minnetonka School District, and I know this isn't just happening in Minnetonka, but the schools are writing the IEPs for special education students, and they're not following the IEPs.
Linda, I'm sorry, for those of us who aren't up on our education jargon, what did you say, an IEP?
An IEP is an individual education plan for special education students.
Okay, thank you.
How do we make the school district accountable to follow the IEPs?
Well, we actually have a division at CFL, Monitoring and Compliance Division. That's their job, to make sure that the IEPs are being followed and that kids are getting the services that they're entitled to. So you would want to make a written complaint to my department, and it would be investigated. If you think that it's not to that level of seriousness, then I would recommend that you talk to the teachers and find out if indeed they're not following it, or if maybe there's just a perception they're not, or if it's being followed in a different way, or if they need help or some kind of resources. It's certainly a concern if an IEP is not being followed, because the child is entitled to it. It's the right thing to do for the child, and it is the law. So I would talk to the principal, talk to the teacher, see what's going on, and if you're not getting resolution, file a complaint with our department.
Chris is on the line with a question for Education Commissioner Christine Jacks. Chris, go ahead, please.
Yes, I was wondering if the state checks into what portion of school money is apportioned to school administration. Seems we hear from teachers that a large portion, an overly large portion of money, is kind of skimmed off the top, by administration.
It's about 5%, a little under.
Okay. That's what I was wondering, because it seems that, schools always needing more money and more money and more money, and then teachers say that, administration has assistance after assistance and stuff like that. And just as a citizen, I just don't know, what to believe, so.
Well, I would say as a general citizen, there are a couple of things that you can do. On our website, which if people haven't visited it in a while, they should. It's really been beefed up, a lot more information to the public. We have a profile of every single district that you can access. So you could actually go look at your district and see how the money is being allocated and figure out what's happening in your own district to answer some of those questions. In addition, a citizen can go in and actually request looking at the entire budget of that district. So you could go into your district and say to the superintendent, or the business manager, I would like to see how much money is being spent on administration, and I would like to know whether that's gone up or gone down or stayed stagnant over the last several years. You're entitled to that information.
In general, can citizens feel reasonably confident that enough money that's being spent on education is actually ending up in the classroom?
The majority of money goes right into classroom instruction, and the segment of the segment of spending that is growing is that segment, the classroom instruction. The average teacher salary has not gone up. Now, one of the reasons is because the average teacher is younger and costs less. So that is one of the components there. But the average teacher salary has not gone up. From what I've seen, the average administrative cost has not gone up. What's gone up is classroom instruction and specifically the cost of special education.
Big increase in state spending on education the last couple of years. Are you satisfied that money has been well spent or is being well spent?
I think that it is being well spent. I think that districts have to make hard choices. I think that citizens can become more active in helping their school board and superintendent make those choices. The governor put a lot of money into education last year, the last biennium and last year, because he did see that there was a need. But he's a fiscal conservative, and he wants to hold the line now. He became elected because he told the people, I'm not going to grow government, I'm going to hold the line. And that's what you're going to see moving forward. You're going to see him ask people to look at their budgets, reallocate where they can, sacrifice things that aren't as important. And you're going to see him instead do tax reform, get money back into the pockets of the people.
But yet you hear from so many people saying, gosh, my schools, they're cutting back, they have to cut this, they have to cut that, they don't have enough money to even buy pencils and paper, we need more money.
Well, it's really interesting. It seems that Minnesotans say we need more money, and they also say we want tax relief. And the harsh reality is we can't have both. Do you want the surplus returned to your pockets? Do you want to have your taxes less? Do you want to have smaller government? If so, you can't continue to add more to programs over and over and over again. And that, I think, is probably going to be the debate we're going to see in the legislature. The governor is going to come forward with a lean, mean budget that says, no, I'm not growing government. That's how I ran. That's what I'm standing for. And then we're going to see what the legislature does. I think that the legislature is not made up of fiscal conservatives like the governor, so I think there probably will be more spending. And then what you'll see us do, especially with education, is say, okay, if you want more money, we want some accountability. If you want it for class size reduction, we want you to prove that that's where it's going. If you want it to go to teacher salaries, we want to have some opportunity for different kinds of compensation models. If you're going to put it toward classroom instruction, we want to have beefed up websites so that people, parents, citizens know where the money is going and know that it's making a difference.
Brita, your question, please.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I actually have two quick questions for you.
Okay.
First of all, I have a friend who's a junior high teacher at one of the Minneapolis public schools that I'm sure is on the not making the grade list. And part of one of her main problems with the school is that she finds it really hard to teach because there's such a discipline problem in her classes that it's really hard to get through to her kids. And so I'm just wondering if you have any comments on that. And my second question is that right now I have two small children and I'm an at-home mom, but when they start school, I'm actually thinking about going into teaching. And the two areas that I'm considering are either elementary ed or science teacher, and I'm just
science. Go into science. We don't need you. We don't need you in elementary education. We have more teachers than we need in elementary education, but we critically need science teachers. So if you are interested in that, we'd love to have you in the field. Please do it. The discipline problem, I think there are two things that need to be done. One, we need to do a better job in induction periods for our teachers, our new teachers coming in. I don't think they're well prepared, well equipped. I don't think that they know what to expect with discipline. Then they're thrown into a classroom, and in the vast majority of schools, the door is shut, and that's the extent of the support they get. In some schools, like Henry, they get a lot of mentoring, a lot of support. We need to see more of that. The other thing is that, you know, we as society need to take a real harsh look at what's going on with discipline problems. And this is not something we can just put on the inner cities. Teachers all over the state are telling me they have discipline problems. Students are less respectful. They're lippy. They're wild. They're violent. And, you know, I'll just get on my soapbox for a second, but look what's on TV. Look how kids are spending their time. Look at how we're role modeling. And I think that we could do a better job. And I think parents need to be held more accountable. I think teachers need to be sending more notes home to parents, making parents leave work and come and sit in the classroom with their kid instead of giving the kid a day off when the kid misbehaves. Mm-hmm. Make the parent come and sit in the classroom.
Do the teachers need more flexibility as well to crack down?
Oh, I think that the teachers are probably using all of the know-how that they have. I think, with the exception of our younger teachers.
Well, I guess legal authority is what I'm talking here.
Well,
I don't know.
Well, you know what? I would say that the teachers have probably tried every strategy. I know that it does help to have smaller class sizes. It does help to be able to pull students away and give them the individual attention that they need. But we don't need to continue to pass out Ritalin, and we don't need to continue to label kids EBD and isolate them. I think we have a bigger societal problem. I think we can do a better job supporting our newer teachers. But I think as society, I think that we as parents need to spend more time with our kids. I think we have to spend more time disciplining our kids, giving them boundaries, teaching them responsibility. And boy, you know, if you find out your kid has sassed the teacher, is misbehaving, you know, don't leave it on the teacher's lap to fix that or change that. As a parent, take responsibility, punish your kid. Don't let that happen again.
Greg, you get the last question here. Quick one, please. We're out of time.
I'd like to know what the commissioner thinks about using the Iowa Basic Skills in lieu of Minnesota grad standards. Has she heard of Singapore math system, and why isn't that being used more? And I'd like to say that a heavy-handed, top-down, tough set of standards from the state is just what we need. Thank you.
Yes, I am familiar with Singapore. As a matter of fact, I went and visited their educational system to see what they're doing in math. Now, they don't have all their kids together. You don't see special education kids at all in their classes, especially not in their math classes. So we have to be careful of what we're comparing. So if, you know, if you pull out the kids who are struggling and then do a comparison, you know, they're going to look better. We have good math. We have some great math coming through right now with the integrated math, the teaching of all of the different subject matters at the same time in a kind of a spiral method. That's proving to be very effective. And I think what's really important to know is that because of the profile of learning, our students are getting more math in school, and they are more competitive now internationally as well as nationally with the math. I don't remember what the first question was.
Basically, I think you've touched on it.
Okay, good.
Very briefly, commission came out and said we ought to spend $500 million a year on pre-K-12 education, get kids ready for school. Do you think that's a good idea?
I think that we have to really take pre-K seriously. What happens before kids enter kindergarten is critical to what's going to happen to them into life. So yes, we have to take pre-K seriously. Whether it's the government's role to put in that much money, to put in $500 million, our governor would say that it is not. Not only is he a fiscal conservative, he thinks that that's a realm that needs to stay more in the hands of parents. So I think that we need to make sure that our parents and the citizens know how important it is, and let's all collaborate and help those younger kids.
Still having fun on the job?
I am. You know, there are days that are hard, but I love the job, and there's always a challenge around the corner.
Thanks for coming in today.
Thank you.
Our guest this hour, Christine Jacks, who's the commissioner of the Children, Families, and Learning Department, basically Minnesota's education commissioner, joining us on this first hour of Midday.
There's more to news than headlines, whether it's foreign affairs, the budget, taxes, education, or even philosophy. Talk of the Nation spends a full hour on each topic that we examine, and that gives you the opportunity to discuss important issues with newsmakers and top experts in the field. I'm Juan Williams. Join us on the next Talk of the Nation every weekday from NPR News.
Talk of the Nation begins at 1 o'clock this afternoon here on Minnesota Public Radio.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Wednesday. It's the 20th of December, 2000. It was on this day in 1985, President Reagan signed a bill establishing a poet laureate for the United States. The first laureate named the year after was Robert Penn Warren. The current poet laureate is Stanley Kunitz. It was in 1957 on this day, Elvis Presley, who was 23 years old, got his induction papers to become a private in the U.S. Army. It's the birthday of Hortense Kalischer, the fiction writer, born in New York City, 1911. Grew up in New York, lived her entire life in the city, wrote almost exclusively about New York. She wrote novels, but she's best known for her short stories, which began appearing in The New Yorker in the 40s. Hortense Kalischer, who once said that the action of a short story is an apocalypse served in a very small cup. Her stories tended to combine a cool narrative with small shocks. In one story, at a dinner party, the women all suddenly remove their blouses. In another story, a bald woman discards her wig while she embraces her lover. Her story collections include In the Absence of Angels and The Collected Stories, which came out in 1975. It's the birthday of the Irish nationalist Maud Gonne, born near Aldershot, England, 1865, brought to Ireland when she was a young girl by her father, who was a British colonel. She was upper class. She was a legendary beauty, 6 feet tall, with cascading red hair. William Butler Yeats, the poet, met Maud Gonne, by then an actress, in 1891 through the Irish theater movement that he'd started. He described her with beauty like a tightened bow, a kind that is not natural in an age like this. He remained chaste until he was 31 in the hopes that she would marry him, but she refused his many proposals of marriage. She focused all of her passion on the cause of Irish independence, campaigning for land reform, and she started a lunch program for school children in Dublin. She was an advocate for political prisoners. She founded the Daughters of Erin. Yeats wrote a play for her, Kathleen Na Houlihan, in which Maud Gonne played the title role. It was on this day in 1860 South Carolina became the first state to secede from the Union. State suffered badly during the Civil War. 65% of the men of South Carolina were killed or wounded, and much of the property was burned to the ground by General Sherman. And it was on this day in 1803 the Louisiana Purchase was completed. There was a ceremony in New Orleans, taking down the flag of France, raising the flag of the United States, to mark the transfer of most of the land between the Mississippi River and the Rocky Mountains, a purchase that doubled the size of the United States. Here's a poem for today by Oscar Wilde, Ave Maria Gratia Plena. Was this his coming? I had hoped to see a scene of wondrous glory, as was told of some great god who in a rain of gold broke open bars and fell on Danae. Or a dread vision, as when Semele, sickening for love and unappeased desire, prayed to see God's clear body, and the fire caught her brown limbs and slew her utterly. With such glad dreams I sought this holy place, and now with wondering eyes and heart I stand before this supreme mystery of love, some kneeling girl with passionless, pale face, an angel with a lily in his hand, and over both the white wings of a dove. Oscar Wilde's poem, Ave Maria Gratia Plena. That's the Writer's Almanac, brought to you by the people at 21NorthMain.com, where book lovers find 13 million gently read classics, bestsellers, and rare masterpieces on the web at 21NorthMain.com. Research by Ellie Jackson. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Regional broadcasts of the Writer's Almanac are supported by Marquette Banks, your community bank, offering a broad range of financial services for your business.